The date is June 7th, 1985, and we are watching The Goonies. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host...
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
So this week, we're looking back at June 1985, when the movies in theaters were Rambo Part 2, Brewster's Millions, A View to a Kill, Fletch... And, of course, our movie for today, The Goonies, which earned $124 million on a $19 million budget.
And a warning for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, which is now 35 years old.
Yeah.
There will be spoilers ahead, so if you don't want to be spoiled, maybe hit pause on this, go watch it, then come back to see us and see if you agree with our critiques.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is... really long. Quote, they call themselves the Goonies, the secret caves, the old lighthouse, the lost map, the treacherous traps, the hidden treasure, and sloth. Join the adventure. That feels like one of the most comprehensive taglines that's possible. But even though this may feel redundant, we go to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
Well, I think the tagline just took care of it, but I'll give it a shot of my own. So, the Goonies are a group of friends from the Goondocks area of Astoria, Oregon. One day, Mikey Walsh, his brother Brand, and their friends Mouth, Data, and Chunk stumble upon a map leading to the treasure of One-Eyed Willie in the Walsh's attic. With their futures and friendships uncertain, threatened by the foreclosure of their family homes, in order to turn the area into a golf course, the Goonies decide to go on one last adventure to do what no one else has been able to do, find One-Eyed Willie's gold. In the process, they are joined by Brand's crush Andy and her friend Steph, and chased by the Fratelli crime family who, upon learning about the treasure, seek to gain it for themselves.
Right on, yes. That is The Goonies. I know that this is one of those ones that is just ingrained in my memory from childhood. I look back at it now. I used to love it as a kid. I mean, it's kind of like Indiana Jones for kids. And then I think back to I look at the fact that I'm now a grown adult and I think, hey, my parents used to watch this with me. You know, what's it like as an adult? So it is very interesting being able to have the perspective of remembering it so fondly from my childhood. This is one of the movies that we've watched that I feel I remember so much better. But Colin, what is your past experience with The Goonies?
I mean, The Goonies is one of those movies that is referenced in almost everything. So it's a movie that I was familiar with a lot of the big lines and the tropes and sloth and that kind of thing. But I'd actually never watched it before. So this was the first time I actually sat down and took the time to watch it finally. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I feel like maybe I did miss out on my childhood just a little bit.
Okay, so let's jump into The Goonies. Directed by Richard Donner, who's known for Superman 1 and 2, the Lethal Weapon series, Scrooged, and produced by Kathleen Kennedy, Frank Marshall, Steven Spielberg. I don't think I need to list any of their credits. I think pretty much some of the most famous producers and directors in Hollywood. And written by Chris Columbus. He gets the screenplay credit on it. And he's known for movies like Home Alone and Harry Potter and Gremlins. And Steven Spielberg gets the story by credit in the writing. And so we open the movie in a jail, where one of the first people we see is the epitome of early 80s fashion, some convict walking by with aviators and a mullet. It was so 80s. And here we go. We're introduced to Jake Fratelli, who is played by Robert Davi. I remember him best from Die Hard. He was one of the Johnson, this one of the Agent Johnsons, and License to Kill. He was a bad guy in that James Bond. And he has faked his suicide in his jail cell as an elaborate ruse to escape prison. A very clever plan, too, using a pipe to hold him up on the bars. But where'd he get that bar from? Like, how did he smuggle that into prison? You don't take a bar that size in the old prison wallet, you know? So I don't understand where this bar came from. Like, are the police officers of Astoria, are they that inept? Is it that small of a town that, you know, that they didn't frisk him fully to make sure he didn't have a giant L-shaped bar in his pocket?
Maybe there's a scene before where it was like his birthday and they smuggled it in a cake.
Yeah.
The old file in the cake trick.
the old bar. And yeah, that one goes in a pie, I think. He overpowers who I can only assume is the only guard in the jail, because he manages to get out of the jail without encountering a single other cop. A small town jailhouse, I guess. But really, the movie opens with prisoners being let out of their cell, so you would assume they're being let out for recreation time in the yard, but then we see the front of the building. It looks like a courthouse or something. Whatever. Prison logic.
It seems like a pretty lazy prison, in my opinion. Like, there's not a lot... There's not a lot of, like, excitement or energy, so maybe they just... They thought, you know, all they need is one guard to kind of take care of.
Yeah, some guy with his feet up on the desk and say, yep. So out front, to take him away in his escape, we meet his brother Francis, who is an unrecognizable Joe Pantoliano. I don't know how to say his last name, but he's in The Sopranos, Memento, Bad Boys, The Matrix, and we meet Mama Fratelli, the fabulous Anne Ramsey, best known as another Mama and Throw Mama from the Train. And so we have this daring escape. They're pouring gasoline and lighting a fire to keep the guards at bay when they get into their car. But we get our first inconsistency with these bad guys, because they're really dark for a kids movie bad guy, but this is one of those cases where they're also bumbling idiots, and they're a lot like the Wet Bandits in Home Alone.
Yeah, like their plan seems to be well executed until the point where they're trying to like unlock the car so he can get in and they can get away.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the forethought to mark out a square of gasoline and light it on fire to keep the 10 guards from following them, but they can't manage door locks.
The only thing that would have been worse would have been Mama going, "Ah, shit, I forgot the keys." Yeah. We ran out of gas. And so then we get the credits of the movie and we follow this police chase around Astoria, and we get a brief glimpse, a little taste, a little amuse-bouche at the Goonies. We've got Data. I'm British all of a sudden. We've got Data, not to be confused with Commander Data from Star Trek, in an alley trying out one of his inventions. We get Mouth cheering on the chase. We get Chunk mashing his pizza and his milkshake against the window, and we get our first shit of the movie for this kids movie, our first shit. I started keeping a shit tally. I got up to 9 before I was too busy taking notes that I forgot to keep track, but I read somewhere that there's like 20 something shits in this movie, and it's a kids movie.
Yeah, there's a few shits. At least like a handful of bullshits.
Yeah, and we got Data spelling out SHIT later on, and we've got Andy with her 80s boombox just being a cheerleader, because, you know, why give anything interesting to the girl character in an 80s movie? And Mama can wheel. She's getting away from the cops, and she ends up on this race on a beach for some reason that's going on, and she just blows past everyone on the beach. You know, how is that possible? I mean,
there's one thing I love about movies, and kind of, I guess, like, this is more of like a movie history thing, but when I watch movies that kind of ape a scene that came before it, and when I was watching, I know the Goonies came first, but when I was watching this scene, there's it's replicated almost exactly as one of the ends of a Fast and the Furious movie. How they escape the police in Brazil or something, and like get all these cars as they just join this massive street race.
So the Goonies needs to sue Vin Diesel. So now we finally get into introductions where we get to meet the characters properly instead of just getting a little taste of them. We're introduced to Mikey Walsh, played by Sean Astin, who is of course Rudy or Samwise Gamgee from The Lord of the Rings. Yeah, he was in a movie called Please Mom Don't Hit Me. Or no, sorry, Please Don't Hit Me, Mom, with his actual real-life mother, Patty Duke. And apparently she actually used to really beat him as a child. So, you know, life imitating art there. And we're introduced to Brandon Brand Walsh. All the characters in the Goonies have nicknames. Brandon's has to be the worst. Let's just call him Brand. But he's played by a very youthful Josh Brolin. Who we know nowadays is Jonah Hex or W.
Still a quite old-looking Josh Brolin relative to everyone else.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how much older he is supposed to be than anyone. But, yeah, and of course, you know, Thanos now. So, you know, fitting for his characters in Deadpool 2 and Thanos, we see Brand working out. Is he actually lifting anything on that machine, or is it like a tension-based machine? Did those exist in the 80s? Because I don't see any weights on the back of that machine. And then we are officially introduced to Mouth. Mouth's real name is Clark Devereaux, I found out. Oh. Played by Corey Feldman, who is, you know, from The Burbs, Lost Boys, Stand By Me, all-around prince of the 80s. Who is living up to his name by talking nonstop, and while Brand exercises now in the living room with his chest spring things that those were something that you used to work out in the 80s. I was hoping he'd pull out a Thighmaster at one point or something like that. And then we are introduced to Chunk. Played by whose real name is Lawrence Cohen, who is played by Jeff Cohen. Jeff Cohen has like 16 credits total, and 3 of them are Goonies related, so he doesn't have a whole lot of an IMDb. Who has to do the truffle shuffle to gain admission to the Walsh house, and this is something where you know, you've got this fat kid. And any 80s movie, you had to have a fat kid wearing a Hawaiian shirt or plaid pants. And we double down on Chunk. He's wearing both. But then we have to fat shame him. And I wouldn't have even thought there was this big deal about him doing this truffle shuffle, except that I found out that they actually cleared the set of all non-essential employees while they did this, which is something that Hollywood people usually only do for like a sex scene, which...
I wouldn't have thought that. I mean, it's kind of impressive that they had the wherewithal to even do that back
then.
That's
true.
For a kid.
Yeah.
For in at a time where it was kind of normal to fat shame.
Yeah.
I guess.
It might have also been because Jeff Cohen had chicken pox and he was just getting over them. So when he lifts his shirt, you can see little red spots. So maybe... maybe it wasn't just body image that he was having a problem with. He was worried that he would get fired for having chicken pox. But, so in order to let him in after he's done the truffle shuffle, we get our first Rube Goldberg moment. Rube Goldberg contraption number 1 to open the gate. How many eggs a day does that chicken lay? I mean, you know, and then it also asked me the question of how did Mouth get in? Why didn't he have to go through this? Did they know they only had one egg in that chicken? And so that was the only way they had to let one person in, and they had to pick and choose.
The thing I find shocking about that is that that's their house.
Yeah.
Like, it's their normal house. Like, if it was a clubhouse or something like that, I could understand a little bit more, but that's like their actual family home.
Yeah. The parents are either the coolest parents ever for letting them do this, or they are just the biggest pushover parents ever. Because, like, next we're introduced to Data, whose real name is Richard Wang.
Dick Wang.
Yeah, you make the the only non-Caucasian in Astoria. You make him a kid named Dick Wang. It's kind of like in 16 Candles, the Long Duck Dong character. But Data is introduced by Ki Hui Kwan, if I'm pronouncing that right. He was short round in the Temple of Doom the year before. But he zip lines in to the while playing the James Bond thing. But this is where, you know, the Walsh house, yeah, they've got the Rube Goldberg set up. The neighbor kid is has a zip line attached to their house. Yeah, what are the parents doing? And the other question I have here is, you know, we know that the Goonies are losing their house and that they're going to be moving shortly. Why has nothing started being packed up?
Yeah.
You know, like, we end up with, when Rosalita comes in, that's part of the reason she's hired, is to help them move. And Mom has the broken arm, but it's just, you know, they haven't even started. Like, there's no attempts at packing up happening. But we get Chunk being the fat kid in the movie. He's clumsy. And so he knocks over the David statuette that Mom has on the coffee table, and breaks off Mom's favorite piece.
Which, AKA the Richard Wang.
Yeah. And so we got another dick joke here. And Mouth says, "You wouldn't be here if it wasn't." This is a kid's movie. Why are you making jokes like that? And how do a group of boys not know which way a penis is supposed to point? Right? You know, Bran says you'd be pissing in your own face. Again, a kid's movie. But I don't understand how boys don't know what a penis looks like. I mean, I guess maybe if you look down, that I don't know. It just makes no sense to me. But then we enter Mrs. Walsh with her broken arm, played by Mary Ellen Trainer, who was in Die Hard and the Lethal Weapon series, and Rosalita, played by Lupe Ontiveros, who is actually the subject of this week's Bit Player Spotlight. Guadalupe Moreno, born September 17th, 1942, grew up in El Paso, Texas. She attended Texas Women's University. That shows you that she went to university in the 60s, in Denton, Texas, where she received a bachelor's degree in social work. After university, she married Elias Ontiveros, and they moved to California so he could start an automotive business. They had three children together, and she decided she was tired of social work and was contemplating returning to school to become a nurse when she saw an article about the need for local film extras. With her husband's encouragement, she went for it, started going by Lupe Ontiveros, and leaving behind 18 years of social work to become a successful onstage and screen actress. She has 107 screen credits, most of which, she jokes, were maids. Her first screen credit was in a 1976 episode of Charlie's Angels. She appeared in shows like Eight is Enough, Soap, Alice, BJ and the Bear, and Hill Street Blues, which seems to be an 80s rite of passage for actors. And movies like Cheech and Chong's next movie, Down and Out in East LA, and most notably, Selena. Later in life, she received an Emmy nomination for a recurring role she had on Desperate Housewives, but sadly, she died August 2nd, 2012, at the age of 69 from a battle with liver cancer. And that is our Bit Player Spotlight.
Wow.
Yeah. So Rosalita, who doesn't speak a lick of English, is shown around by Mom, past Brand in gravity boots, because, you know, let's throw in as many ridiculous exercises as possible.
He loves to spend the first 15 minutes of that movie working out.
Yeah, in one way or another, but all with, like, these bizarre workouts instead really of, like, sitting there doing push-ups. Or
really obscure 80s workout gear. Like, if that movie was made now, he would be using, like, one of those vibrator belts or shake weights.
Shaky weighty. Yeah. And so, she is shown around the house by Mom. And Mouth comes along to translate because he says he speaks Spanish. And I really got a kick out of this. They definitely have a lot of fun with subtitles in this movie. I mean, when they're trying to fix the penis on the statue earlier, they're subtitling Chunk because his mouth is full. And so Mouth is translating everything into Spanish for Rosalita's sake, and he's talking about, you know, this is where the heroin goes and the marijuana goes in the bottom drawer. Or he's talking about, this is where you get locked up with no food and water. And he's talking about sexual torture.
Yeah. And I mean, this is something we'll talk about later once we get to the map. But when I first watched it, I didn't understand if he was like messing with her.
Yeah.
Or if he just has has a really loose grip on how to speak Spanish.
Yeah, but like a lot of the words that he's coming up with, though, I think about the fact that, you know, I took high school French, and yeah, I wouldn't have been able to put together a sentence that I hadn't already figured out all the words for. So
yeah, like how does he know how to say heroin and cocaine?
Yeah, I don't
like,
think
does he grow has he grown up
I don't think the phrase sexual torture comes up a lot in a middle school Spanish class, you know.
Yeah.
So they're all shown around, but again, you know, yeah, some of the things he's saying to her, I'm reminded this is a kid's movie. But yeah, so we Mom has to leave. She needs to go grocery shopping. Rosalita goes with her, and all the kids go up to the attic. I forget why they go up to the attic. Did Mom tell them to grab something out of the attic or something? I don't remember why. But what a weird attic.
I think they knew. I think it was like a place that they go to just look at all his dad's like weird stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Maybe it's just like, yeah, it's like going to the woods and looking at the old Playboys that you have in the treehouse. This is the equivalent to that because he's got so many weird things. Yeah, and his attic kind of looks like a museum, which he's a curator of. So maybe he's got a side business where he's stealing everything from the museum, selling it on Antique Roadshow. And so, for some reason, we've got plasma lamps that are plugged in. I don't know why you would store them plugged in. You've got Mouth being an asshole and destroying one of the paintings by sticking his tongue through it. And, of course, Clumsy Chunk knocks over a picture. But they manage to find the map and the key. And we learn all about the history of One-Eyed Willie and Chester Copperpot. And we get all that exposition. Sean Astin was actually, instead of them scripting this story, Richard Donner took him aside and told him the story and then had him repeat it on camera, which is why it comes out so breathless and like someone actually trying to remember. So that's a detail I appreciate because it makes it feel more authentic. And so we learn all about them with all the conveniently placed articles. And then we're back downstairs and Mouth says something lippy to Brand and he's sitting on the sink and Brand turns on the tap. And I sat there watching this whole scene going, someone turn off the tap, because no one did. And it just one of those details of a movie that bugged me. But Brand has been left in charge. And so what does he do? He goes back to his spring chest thing while watching Cyndi Lauper's Goonies Are Enough video playing on TV. Google the video. It's bonkers. It's made in the prime of the 80s when there was a story that went around with videos often. And she's got like WWF stars playing her parents and everything. Google it. It's amazing. But he ends up getting overpowered because the kids want to go on this quest. He gets tied up with his spring weights and the kids bike away. When Rosalita comes back in and sees him tied to the chair, she's got the best reaction when she like drops the groceries and she's like, oh my God, you know, because after everything that Mouth just told her, she thinks this family is crazy. And so because Melth let out the air of the tires, when Bran finally does escape, he does the most logical thing and steals a little girl's bike. And this ends up bringing us to our intro to Troy, played by Steve Antin, who is busy adjusting his mirror to look up Andy's skirt in this kid's movie. And so, yeah, this is where we meet Steph Steinbrenner. She has the last name Steinbrenner, played by Martha Plimpton. She's in Parenthood and a bunch of meh credits. And the reason why to this day I've got a thing for redheads, her and the Little Mermaid are the reason why I have a thing for redheaded women. This was one of my young crushes, Andy Carmichael, played by Cary Grant.
Which brings us to another segment of ours. I wonder what happened to that guy. Or in this case, that girl. So the subject of this week's I Wonder What Happened to That Girl is Cary Grant, who, like Sean said, plays Andrea Andy Carmichael, which I read that, like, when I went on Wikipedia and saw all these people's last names, I don't know that any of them were actually ever mentioned other than the Walshes.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that they even bother to have, like, actual names.
Well, and it's like Chunk, his character's last name is his own last name.
Yeah.
So
according to IMDb, it was actually a fortuitous decision to skip summer camp in 1984 and head to New York for some movie auditions that brought Cary Grant to the attention of Steven Spielberg, which led her to being cast as Andy in The Goonies. Along with The Goonies, Green is best known for starring in Summer Rental in 1985, alongside John Candy.
Yeah, that's one of I love that one.
And the 1986 movie Lucas, where she finds herself the center of a love triangle once again, but this time between Charlie Sheen and Corey Haim. Her career slowed down considerably in the 90s. She made a few TV appearances with small parts on Mad About You, Murder, She Wrote, ER, and Law & Order SVU. I wrote this just because the movie itself was hilarious. She starred in a movie called Blue Flame, and I'm just going to read the brief description to you. So, Fleming, a futuristic cop, saw his daughter kidnapped by Flame and Rain, two aliens that were born out of his own dreams. And Cary Grant plays Rain, one of the aliens. So.
Awesome. Amazing.
Yeah, so that was kind of, I think that was like the last movie that she was in.
What year was that? Did you write that down?
It was in 1994.
Oh, I think, okay, yeah. Okay.
91 or 94. She was in one movie later. But yeah. Between 94 and 2000, she took a break from acting to study art at Vassar College, where she actually was a roommate with Marissa Tomei's brother and the BioShock developer, Ken Levine.
Huh.
In 1996, she co-founded a film production company called Independent Women Artists with Bonnie Dickinson, and they co-wrote and directed a film adaptation of Belly Fruit, which is a play about teen pregnancy. Her last film appearance was a role in 2012. This is just like a small movie with a $500,000 budget called Complacent. I looked it up and I don't even know if it was actually released in theaters.
YouTube.
I couldn't find like a gross or like a box office gross or anything like that. So
someone put that out as a million different Twitches.
Yeah. And so yeah, that's Cary Grant's career in a nutshell.
Right on. Okay, so yeah, they come across Brand, the two girls, and asshole Troy, biking, and then they start. He grabs onto Brand's hand and starts accelerating his car, and straight up almost murders.
Yeah, sends him flying into oblivion.
Yeah, like homicide is fun, kids. This is a kids' movie. Yeah, sends him flying over a cliff, and meanwhile the kids have used the medallion with some of the worst blue screen effects ever. To find out that their treasure map starts at a restaurant where the Fratellis happen to be hiding. And they have the line of, that's a summer place. What's it doing open this late? You know, like, why is this summer place open in the fall?
It clearly hasn't been open for at least 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's why is this place still open should be the better question, because it looks condemned. They walk up to the door. There's a Pepsi cooler on the porch, which Chunk is disappointed is empty because he's fat. This brings us to a segment we like to call Sponsorship Corner. Now, as always, one of my favorite things about these older movies is the blatantly obvious product placement. So, The Goonies is brought to you by Pepsi, Nike Shoes, Swenson's Ice Cream, Wonder Bread, Jeep Cherokee XJ, Michelin Tires, Domino's Pizza, and of course, Baby Ruth. This has been Sponsorship Corner. And so the squad now goes into the restaurant, meets the Fratellis. I do appreciate, like, looking at it from my perspective as an adult, realizing why this scene is so visceral to a child. Because they really are, like, imposing and terrifying. And so I realize that everything is shot from lower camera angles. And when they're speaking Italian, there's no subtitles. So this is one of the cases where, again, you know, they're making brilliant use of the subtitles in this movie. And it makes it so much more real as a kid. Like, I can remember how scary this reveal of the Fratellis was. And now watching it, it's like, that's how they pulled it off. It was...
I feel like when you're a kid, you have more feelings of being scared. And so when you're in movies and you also, like, identify more with the characters when you watch movies, I think, sometimes. So when you're in those types of situations and the way they're shot, I feel like as a kid, when I'd watch movies like that, I'd feel more scared for them and myself just by the situation. Whereas as an adult, you don't really get that as much.
Yeah, like, there's a story about E.T. where Steven Spielberg made sure that he filmed everything from a child's height in that movie. So that when, like, the adults come in towards the end, they're that much scarier and all that sort of thing. You know, it's nice to have those little details. But, yeah, so the kids walk in and somehow they still think it's a functional restaurant, even when they get served orange water. Mikey decides he has to pee. He goes down downstairs and we get our first glimpse of Sloth. I'm assuming it must be Sloth's Fratelli. Yes. I guess so. Who is played by John Matuszak, who was a defensive end for the Oakland Raiders from 1976 to 1982. Won two Super Bowls.
Sloth has to be a nickname, though, right? Like, they couldn't have been so mean to have called him Sloth before they started dropping
him. Yeah, comes right out of the womb, and it's like, he looks like a sloth. I mean, sometimes you have to wait till the kid is born to name them, but I don't think you've got Sloth in your back pocket. It's got to be. It's probably his name is like, Stanley Fratelli or something like that, and, you know, they just call him Sloth. So Mikey undoubtedly freaks out, runs back upstairs. The Fratellis aren't around anymore, but Brand has magically shown up out of nowhere, so I guess he didn't get murdered. And the kids are dragged out by Brand, and somehow Andy and Steph have also found them. You know, this restaurant in the middle of nowhere that they had to follow a treasure map to find. You know, somehow everyone has been like, that makes sense. I think that's where they'd go. You know, that makes perfect sense.
It's kind of also odd, though, that as Brand shows up, they just kind of let him go. Like, you get the sense that the Fratellis were preparing to kind of murder the kids. But then Brand shows up and he's so intimidating and badass with his bandana that he just grabs the kids and they get out.
Yeah, in his 80s sweatshirt, gray sweatshirt. Yeah, and so they watch the Fratellis from afar, watch them like load a dead body into their car or into the restaurant. I forget which way. This dead body seems to be moving around all over the place anyway. And they wait for the Fratellis to leave, and then they break back in. And to get back in, Melth uses Chunk as a battering ram by saying that he has naked pictures of his mom in the tub. And I'm reminded once again that this is good, wholesome, family fun kids movie. yeah, and of course Buzzkill Steph doesn't want to be there because Steph is pretty much only there just to be annoying and a very uncomfortable, awkward love interest for Melth later on. They go downstairs to look at Sloth like he's a carnival freak because Mikey has told them that there's something in the basement. But, you know, let's go down into a creepy basement to look at a carnival freak and way too much romance for Andy and Brand because they're about to kiss and they end up getting, like, cock-blocked all over the place a couple times because all the kids are terrified of Sloth. They end up finding a counterfeit money press in the basement that Data figures out how to turn on. And it takes the kids way too long to figure out that it's fake money. You know, my favorite is probably Brand's reaction when he sits there and stares at it for like a good 2-3 seconds. And then he goes, wait, this is fake. You know, you know, but they think they're going to be able to save the house with this fake money. The Fratellis end up coming home. And there's so much passion over pepperoni. You know, was the word pizza copyrighted at this point? Because the pepperoni is, you know, he goes, hey, I want some pepperoni. You want some pepperoni? I'll give you some pepperoni. The Fratellis are arguing. And then Chunk, being the fat kid, almost ruins it all because he's like, they've got pepperoni? And so, yeah, Chunk is almost the downfall of the entire squad. But because of...
Chunk is like Garfield with lasagna. You know, like whenever Garfield would come across lasagna, he'd just float up in the sky and like drift over.
But it doesn't matter which what kind of food it is. Yeah, just food. Food is an analog for lasagna in this case. Yeah, but because of a bottle of water that Chunk clumsily knocked over earlier, like are all the major plot points because of Chunk's clumsiness? Like, because he's a klutz, they found the map. Because he's a klutz, they find out that. There's an open drain or open hole underneath the fireplace. But yeah, the squad figures out they can escape through the fireplace, but Chunk is locked in a freezer with a dead body, which is one of these moments where, okay, we get our bumbling idiot wet bandit type Fratellis, and then this is, you know, you've got a dead body on ice with a bullet hole in his head. So much inconsistency with the bad guys. So, this is where we now split the movie into two simultaneous stories. So first we're going to look at Chunk, so we're not bouncing back and forth. Chunk's story, while these two different plots are going on, he escapes through the basement window to go call the cops, and the rest of the gang explores the caves. So he escapes. He calls a cop who doesn't believe him. Because Chunk tells tall tales all the time.
It's boy who cries wolf.
So, yeah, you know. Exactly. I love that for Chris Columbus's sake, they threw in a Gremlins reference here. The cop is saying, yeah, this is probably like the time you told me about those creatures that multiply if you put water on them. You know, and then the cop points at the camera and winks and gives you a thumbs up. That's almost what this is like.
Hey, everybody. Editing Sean here. I just wanted to let you know that recording this episode, we had a bit of an audio glitch that happened, and because of that, we lost a minute of our audio, but thankfully had a backup microphone set up. So just bear with us through the next minute of poor audio, because it does only last a minute. Okay, back to the show.
And so then when the cop doesn't believe Chunk, he tries to flag down passing cars, and the one he gets into is the one that Jake Fratelli is driving. And Chunk, of course, has unloaded the entire story of what's going on,
who the bad guys are before realizing who it is. You know, when Jake Fratelli turns on the dome light and we have
that's a big reveal. That's a great shot.
It is a good reveal.
The way that the light comes up and you see his face in the rear view mirror.
But why Chunk had to tell the entire story before, you know. So Chunk is thrown into the back of the Jeep XJ with the dead body. You know, so like this dead body that was in the freezer is now in the trunk, and like they're just moving it around. I can't decide where I want it.
There's no real indication of what the plan was for the dead body, or even who the dead body is.
Yeah, there's absolutely like, is there a deleted scene where they actually explain who this guy was? Maybe it's the owner of the restaurant. Maybe he was like a lonely restaurateur that.
He sleeps on a cot in the back room, and his wife died years ago, and he.
I mean, from the look of him, he looks like he was dead for, like, it was almost like he got killed during whatever crime the Fratellis did last, and they were just storing him there.
The one that Jake was in prison for, okay.
Because, I mean, the body is so blue.
Yeah, it looks thoroughly frozen, yeah.
I can't believe that he's only been dead for the day or so that they've been there.
Yeah. Yeah, so they've managed to recapture him. They take him back to the restaurant, and this is where Chunk confesses fucking everything on the threat of being mulched in a blender. Like, I remember the visual of when she drops in the tomato to show what the blender does. I remember how terrifying that actually was as a child. You know, and later when she says, hit puree. But yeah, Chunk is going back and telling about all the times that he wet his pants or blamed someone for something. Or he's telling, you know, in grade one, I did this. And so, you know, Jake, after Chunk has told them everything, says, I'm really beginning to like this kid. But the Fratellis find the medallion, which inexplicably was left with Chunk for safekeeping. So this is where Chunk yells at his friends to run because the Fratellis are coming after them. He gets chained up with Sloth. He uses the baby Ruth as a peace offering, but he doesn't throw it far enough. So Sloth pulls the chains out of the fucking wall, kisses Chunk on the lips, and the two of them
decide... The romance begins.
The greatest love story of all time. Greatest bromance of all time. Yeah, and they decide to follow them down into the catacombs. So that's Chunk. So meanwhile, the rest of the squad is exploring all these mysterious tunnels below Astoria, Oregon. The tunnel scenes were actually filmed sequentially. And so the cast started abandoning costume pieces that they were annoyed by. So it starts with Steph loses her glasses and is basically Velma from Scooby-Doo for now, for a hot minute. They end up in a sewer area where all the pipes for the city run. I need to see a map of this town. Like, I'm no expert on like a town organization, but the restaurant that they go into seems in the middle of nowhere. But yet they get to these pipes and they start banging on these pipes to get people's attention. And they're now underneath the country club that Troy was on his way into. And we see like taps getting pulled out in the shower. I like the one guy showering for some reason with an eye patch. Maybe it's foreshadowing about One-Eyed Willie. But like, I don't understand the layout of the town.
I think it must be on, I'll pull out a big word, like a peninsula. Yeah. You know? Like it's on the corner between, so it's like sidelined by two bodies of water. Because they go in and there's water, and spoilers, they come out and there's water.
Yeah.
But somehow they also seem to make it through to like the town center eventually where they meet Troy at the well. And then they continue on.
But then it's like, you know, what's the point? Like, okay, so if they're going across this peninsula and the country club is in the middle, like, why wouldn't the quest just start right where the ship is then? Like, you're basically saying the beginning of the quest is on one side of this landmass. It just, I don't know. It's just so bizarre. And then for One-Eyed Willie to have the foresight that one day this would just be a regular city sewer. I mean, that's impressive that that's part of this quest. is them walking through this sewer.
Yeah, that is true. I never thought about that.
But I mean, they have to be in a populated area, because later when Chunk and Sloth come by and Sloth pushes up on the pipes, you know, you get the comical sound effects of cars crashing. So, like, whatever they're doing obviously affects, like, even heavy traffic. So it's just, I don't know. The layout of this town makes no sense to me. I don't get it. But it does give us the treat of being able to see Troy on a toilet reading Guns and Ammo magazine and then getting blown off the toilet and then screaming because an 80s movie has to have a grown whiny boy, Daddy! Troy is just like, he's just a waste. He makes no sense to me. The whole Troy storyline almost seems like it's absolutely pointless.
Yeah, he's one of those characters you could take out. The only thing he is like a little bit to have a foil, like an adversary for Bran.
Yeah.
But barely.
And
it's pretty clear straight off the bat that Annie isn't even really into him at all.
Yeah, and the Fratelli should be enough of a foil for Bran. They have actual guns. I mean, you know, Troy tries to do vehicular manslaughter instead. You know, like, maybe that's Troy's only purpose, is to slow Bran down a little bit more so that the kids have time to get to the restaurant. I don't know. But yeah, so Andy is busy losing her shit, and when they come across the crushed skeleton of Chester Copperpot, a creepy skeleton for a kids movie. And they go through his wallet. They find a Lou Gehrig baseball card. They say, "Who's this?" And I'm sitting there thinking, this could save the house. Like, unless sports cards weren't a big thing in the 80s, which I'm pretty sure they were.
Their height.
Yeah. But, you know, like, the kids have never heard of Lou Gehrig. I mean, I don't even follow baseball, and I know who Lou Gehrig is. He's got my favorite disease. Oh, that's too soon. Too soon. Okay, so, and they also find candles. And I have quotation marks around candles because, of course, one of them is a stick of dynamite. But I actually thought that they were all sticks of dynamite until later in the movie, in the part where they actually light the candles. And I forgot that they actually had that part in the movie. But we've got the best visual gag when the... when the head of Chester Copperpot comes off and Bran puts it back on and then wipes his hand on Melf. That is brilliant. And this is also the point that Bran loses the headband because Josh Brolin was tired of wearing it. So Mikey sets in motion our Rube Goldberg contraption number 2, Too Fast, Too Rubious. By pulling on a tripwire. My favorite thing about this tripwire is the fact that he has to, like, dig it out of the sand. Like, he doesn't even trip on it. It's like, oh, what's this? Stop touching stuff. So we've got the rocks start falling from the ceiling. This is the deadly Rube Goldberg. This is where Data screams, holy S-H-I-T, because the actor promised his mom he wouldn't curse in the movie. And they narrowly escape through a hole in the wall. Are they blocked in? Like, how do the Fratellis get past that rock later on? Like, it, like, closes and covers the hole, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, when they're, well, the rocks that are coming down are, like, kind of flat. Like, it's almost like what it'd be like one of those situations where they could hit the ground and fall flat, so you might still be able to take
it. It would be like the effort of tipping over a vending machine or something. Yeah. Then okay, so two people might be able to do that, I guess.
I think they're meant to try to kill you, not necessarily to trap you.
Yeah, so they because they're trapped and decide to keep moving forward, Bran decides to move a rock, and Steph gets her only good line of the movie: God put that rock there for a reason. And then we get bats flying out at them.
The worst
bats. Like, the ones that are shooting out of the cave, I read, were, like, tied up garbage bag pieces and just blown out of an air cannon.
Ones that are in the close-up shots are clearly just, like, those rubber Halloween decoration
bats. Spencer gift bats, yeah. I swear I saw a string on one of them.
Yeah.
And they find their way into the bottom of the most fucked-up wishing well ever. Like, they've got all these steps and everything. Like, if... are all wishing wells like this, you wouldn't get the bucket back up. And so this is where we get a lot of big moments, because Mouth gets his Oscar speech about taking all his wishes back. This wish here, this is mine. I'm taking it back. I'm taking them all back. And up top of the well, Troy makes a reappearance, making a wish to basically date rape Andy.
It's a nice contrast of the emotion of Mouth and just the, like, I don't even know what the word is, the rapey vibes of Troy.
Very rapey vibes. Very, you know, like, he flips in a coin and makes a wish, and they flip it back out, and he realizes Andy's in the bottom, and he says, "See, guys, wishes really do come true."
I just wanted to say, with Mouth's monologue, I don't know. For me, it kind of felt a little flat. I think just because I don't really know what his issue is at this point. Like, I don't know what's happened to him.
It's a very impassioned speech, yeah.
Yeah, he's so passionate, but I don't understand why he's so angry or upset. Is it because he's losing his friend? Is it because he's losing his house?
It's like, dude. What were you wishing for?
Who hurt you?
What wishes didn't come true? Yeah. Did Santa not bring you a bike? I don't know. I like to retcon the idea that he comes from a very, very abusive household or something like that. Yeah. Or his mom's an alcoholic and his dad walked out one day to buy a pack of cigarettes and never came home. He's Nelson from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Daddy? And so he's been wishing every weekend for his dad to come back. So most of those coins actually are his. We have a chance to be rescued by douchebag Troy, but Mikey gives his impassioned speech about Goonies never saying die, and this is our time now, to which Andy says, "But I'm not a Goonie," and Mikey says, "I forgot." Like, at this point, don't you want to, you know, like, throw her a freaking bone? It's like, you've come this far. You're a Goonie now, Toots. Like, you know, like, you know, Steph, you're still not a Goonie because you suck. But Andy, you can be a Goonie. You're an honorary Goonie. Like, at least give her an honorary Goonie. Like when they get someone famous at a university to give a speech and give them an honorary degree. Okay.
It's okay because in 2 minutes, Troy is going to dub her a Goonie anyways, and we move on with the stories.
That's right. So, yeah, exactly. Instead of a rescue, we get Troy basically gets dumped with the message because his Letterman jacket is now on the bucket. I don't understand how those two guys, his two goons heaving on the bucket...
Also, no human being could fit through that hole.
Oh, I know. It looks so small. That is a tiny, tiny well. But I don't understand how they don't realize that, hey, wait a minute. This is an empty bucket. That's just the weight of a Letterman sweater on there. But yeah, this is where we end up with, he realizes that she's not coming back to him. And this is where he screams out, "Andy, you Goonie!" You know, like, okay, fine. She's a Goonie now, so...
I feel like...
Joke's on you, Mikey.
What's his name? Scott Anton?
Steve
Anton, who plays Troy? I bet he watches that to this day and wishes he had another take. Another shot at delivering that line.
Yeah. Richard, could I redo this? Nope. We got it. It's in the can. Yeah. Unless he was told to do it like that. So the squad, reinvigorated by Mikey's speech, they continue on their journey, and Mikey sets off Rube Goldberg contraption number 3, Rube Harder. I named them all. Nice. I don't know if you noticed that. which is a little wink and a nod and a thumbs up to the camera for Steven Spielberg, because it's got the mini Raiders of the Lost Ark ball that rolls down towards him, because he figures out that the key he has turns in something on the wall and nearly kills Data, who falls in a spike-filled pit. But luckily, one of his Inspector Gadget inventions on his belt finally works! I'm sitting there watching it though, and he seems to be falling forever.
A very long time.
Yeah, because it's kind of like he has enough time to go, shit, I'm falling. Okay, he pulls back his jacket. He finds the right belt button on his thing. The chattering teeth and spring, because that's what saves his life. Manages to get up to the top in time. You know, but the pit itself looks like it's like 12 feet deep.
Yeah. Also, in what world could plastic teeth bite onto dirt hard enough to hold any human being's mass?
And why didn't it crumble up? Well, it's just like later on, he uses the teeth and, you know, with on the bad guys, and it ends up like crushing the guy's nuts. Like, how are these things so strong anyway? But yeah, everybody presumably follows him down the hole. How? There's no ladders. I don't know. They managed to make a human ladder down the side of the hole or something. Unless that's not actually where they went. I don't know. But then this is where they finally get a chance to take the bathroom break in the skull-shaped cave area. Has Mikey been holding it this whole time? He had to go to the bathroom in the restaurant, and it never came up again. Unless he, like, peed himself when he saw a sloth. But I guess maybe that's a possibility too. So yeah, they've got the girls' room, they've got the boys' room, and Bran goes to the men's room, which of course is slowly followed by everyone except Mikey. And then Mikey gets a chance to make out with Andy in the dark, because Andy thinks he's Bran, even though he's like a good foot shorter. And Steph is, like, creepily watching them in the corner. She knows what's going on, even in the dark.
Does Steph hate Andy? Like, is there jealousy there?
I don't know. Like,
because she knows. Why would she just let it? Why would she just watch and let it happen?
Yeah, because she says, no, over this, you know, this way, Casanova or the lover boy or whatever she says. Like, she knows it's him, you know, but she's sitting there with her fingers tented together like, like, and even Mr. Burns. And
and even when Mikey comes out, she doesn't tell Andy that, like, it was him. She just lets her believe it was Bran.
Yeah, exactly. But she figures it out later. So the Fratellis are catching up, and they have to get across an underwater river. And then we get to cue the Bumbling Crook music. This is where it suddenly gets goofy, and we've got cartoon sound effects with the boxing glove and people getting hit in the nuts and slick shoes. And it's just so much inconsistency with the Fratellis, with the bad guys. You know, they're just now they're morons. And we come to the bone organ, which is definitely a creepy thing to put in a kid's movie. And it's Andy's turn to shine. If she can only find middle C and play the chords on the back of the map. And every time she hits a wrong note, the floor falls away, which is terrifying. And every time she hits the correct chord, the drawbridge to the side opens up. And they get through, and they slide down the conveniently smooth water slide. I mean, you'd think it would be made out of rock, but, like, I don't think that there's any rock with any amount of erosion that is...
It's made out of bone.
All the extra skulls that you don't see. Just crushed down and laminated somehow. So they slide down, and we come to an absolutely gorgeous set, the pirate ship. The kids in this movie were able to give authentic reaction because they were actually banned from the set for the entire filming of the movie, so that they would see it for the first time when they were filming. Even in the scene when they come out of the water water slides, and, you know, they've got their back to the ship, and so those are all authentic reactions. Except Corey Feldman, because he was a little prick that snuck onto the soundstage and admitted it. And this is where the deleted octopus scene would have happened. One of the most terrible scenes. Google that shit, because wow, was that a dumb scene. I don't know how that didn't make it into the final film. And so the kids get onto the ship, and we're treated to a whole bunch more skeletons. in the kids' movie. And Andy sets off Rube Goldberg contraption number 4, electric Rubaloo. See, yeah, I thought that one was clever. And before we can actually read what is written on that trap door on the ceiling, because they don't care about touching things anymore at this point, they break through and we find One-Eyed Willie. But for some reason, Mikey wants a few minutes alone with One-Eyed Willie. What is Mikey's deal?
I don't know, man. And the fact that One-Eyed Willie is in this ship creates a host of problems for me in terms of the logic. And he would just... One-Eyed Willie had to have been insane. You have to think, like, this pirate ship is just sitting, has just been sitting in this cave. He's in it. He set up all these traps, presumably to prevent people from getting his gold. Yeah,
he's painted himself into this corner.
But then the rock face that eventually blows up based on, I think it's the next Rube Goldberg situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the cannons knock out the sidewall. There was no plan of escape.
Yeah.
He just sat there counting his gold and died.
And there's other skeletons around the corner. Around the table, I mean, and it's like, okay, so he just sat there and watched them all die and then waited to die himself sitting in a chair. And like, how many times do you think maybe he like accidentally bumped the table and knocked off a coin off the scale and everything went off and he was like, ah, shit, the cave broke apart again. I gotta go fix that now.
That's just always like a weird trope around pirates is like, pirates spend so much time seeking buried treasure and finding gold that they apparently don't ever have plans to do anything with. They just hoard it.
Yeah. So Mikey is alone with One-Eyed Willie, which is just, he's got this very weird relationship with One-Eyed Willie. This guy that he, you know, barely remembered a story from when he was a kid. Now
all of a sudden it's so important to him.
Yeah, he's like in the presence of a god or something like this. Yeah. Like he just...
I feel like there's something in an alternate version or like a deleted scene where the story of One-Eyed Willie more accurately mirrors Mikey's story somehow, that there's a connection there, because but that really doesn't come through at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, he gets the line, so that's why they call you One-Eyed Willie, when he lifts up the eye patch to find, like, a filled-in bone saw or eye socket. But it's like the eye patch that he was... Enough. Yeah, that wasn't enough for you. Oh, maybe that's why they call you One-Eyed Willie, you know? Because if it wasn't for the fact that it was, like, filled in bone, if he had been one-eyed, you wouldn't have been able to tell what was under that empty socket. Like, it's even weirder because his eye is filled in that you would even think to look. But so, yeah, so we, the rest of the squad has snuck up behind him while he's having this emotional moment with One-Eyed Willie. They've all got the candles. Luckily, no one lit that one stick of dynamite. How'd they light those? Right, like they just waded through water.
Yeah.
If one of them had a lighter, I've had a lighter get wet and it takes like hours to dry out. You know, if matches get wet, they're like destroyed useless. For good. Yeah, they're like, even when they dry out, they're useless. So how did they light those? Did they find a box of matches just lying around on the lower deck? I don't know. But they're all there and they're all a little bit choked up because of how great Mikey's chat with Willie was. And then they start filling their pockets with gold and jewels, but not those ones, not those ones in front, because those are Willie's. Yeah. The Fratellis find them. And so this is actually one of the first times that Mikey is smart enough to not touch the wrong thing, right? This is how they set off the fifth trap. The Fratellis do later on. And it's like the one smart time that he's not pulling on a tripwire or trying. So, yeah, but the Fratellis find them and order them out onto the main deck. The girls have a moment, which is such a, you know, let's make a joke about girls moment, where they're both wearing necklaces. They're being ordered out onto the deck at gunpoint. And they're, oh, you look so, oh, you know, like they have this moment where they break and look at their pretty necklaces.
We're going to take the time to admire each other's outfits.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what girls do. Just us girls.
And then they're ordered to empty their pockets before they have to walk the plank, which I'm sure is more terrifying if you're in the middle of the ocean like you're supposed to be when you're ordered to walk the plank as a pirate.
I mean, walking the plank would have actually maybe been more terrifying if they had kept the fact that there was a giant octopus in the water.
Exactly. But that scene was terrible. So it's better that we are just left scratching our heads wondering why it's less terrifying than it should be.
Yeah.
And then now all of a sudden none of Data's inventions work at all. But those glitches also match the klutziness of the Fratellis.
My favorite thing about Data's stuff in this scene is, like, back when they're still in the tunnels, he uses the boxing glove to effectively knock out Jake and set the Fratelli brothers back. But when they're on the pirate ship, he opens his thing, the glove flies out and straight up punches Data right on the chin. And he's just completely unfazed by it.
Yeah. like it's more of those inconsistencies. But finally, Chunk and Sloth finally rejoin the A-plot with arguably the most famous line of Goonies, which is the, "Hey, you guys!" Yeah, and they swing into the rescue, slide down the sail with a knife. It's a good thing that Sloth was watching pirate movies in the beginning so that we understand why he knows how to do this. And he's got a very obviously fake Chunk on his back. They didn't even get a stuntman to do this. It's obviously a mannequin. And we get a wacky, chaotic fight. All of a sudden, everyone wants to use a sword to fight. You know, they've got guns.
It's pirates.
But let's be pirates, yeah. Let's, you know, when in Rome. And Andy ends up getting knocked overboard. Bran dives in to rescue her. And once he does, leaves her tied up to kiss her. Because, you know, that's gentlemanly. You know, and she has the line of, "What happened to your braces?" Which is when they both realize that she had kissed Mikey. Sloth is now on their side, though, because of Chunk, because of their bromance. He rips off his shirt to reveal his Superman shirt underneath. Interestingly, by the way, the shirt that he rips off is an Oakland Raiders t-shirt, which is great for John. This is John Mantuzak's big thumbs up and wink to the camera. I played for the Oakland Raiders. But yeah, he's got the Superman shirt underneath, and we get a little brief clip of the Superman theme, which is the Richard Donner thumbs up to the camera. Through all this scuffle, they manage to set off Rube Goldberg contraption number 5. Goldberg takes Manhattan because those greedy fuckers want Willie's personal gold because everything else is not good enough. And this is the one that makes the whole cave just start collapsing because of the cannons going off and the terrible rock falling effects. And the squad manages to blow their way out of the side of the cave with dynamite, which, isn't it wet? Like, I was complaining about matches a second ago. What about the wet dynamite? That's not going to light. I don't know. Sloth manages to hold their opening for them so that the rocks don't collapse in on themselves. And everyone crawls through his legs. He has a moment where he awkwardly hugs Chunk to his crotch. Like, face to crotch. It's just this really awkward hug that it's kind of like, maybe Richard Donner should have thought of a different way to block that scene. But I don't know.
They didn't think it was stuff like that.
I guess so. I mean, it
was pre-Michael Jackson.
but with all their weird, like, pseudo romantic bromance that they've got going on here, you know,
it was a more innocent time.
It was a much more innocent time. But yeah, they managed to escape, and they are found on the beach by a couple of cops driving ATVs that call them goobers. So I guess, you know, word hasn't spread that Annie's a goonie. She's still just a goober. So, and Richard Donner is actually one of those cops. They're all reunited with their parents, And it's just funny how obvious all the parents are for which kid they belong to. You know, like, oh, the fat parents wearing Hawaiian shirts? I wonder whose they are. I mean, okay, the Asian parents, I don't think they're going to end up being Mouse parents. But, but you know, Dad is exactly the same. Dad is wearing a stupid gizmo belt as well.
Yeah.
And so most of those parents are actually the kids' real parents or relatives of some sort. And then we the Fratellis conveniently come out of the ocean right where all the cops in town are. But Chunk uses himself and his Domino's pizza box as a shield to protect Sloth because he loves Sloth. And now Sloth...
Don't you think it's crazy that, like, Chunk's parents had the wherewithal to be like, when we find our boy, he's gonna want pizza. So, like, let's make sure we have pepperoni on hand.
It's gotta be the pizza. Yeah, and Sloth is invited to come live with Chunk. You know, he's got this Disney princess-like courtship with Chunk that he falls in love with Chunk over the period of one day. And invites Chunk to live with him. You know, it makes you wonder what the next day is like. You know, you've taken this guy that obviously has some sort of PTSD from being chained up in a basement and obviously had a bad upbringing by the looks of this crime family that he was raised by. And let's just invite this adult stranger with the goofy face. Of course, I do appreciate the makeup. I think the makeup is one of the effects that actually has held up. Yeah. The Sloth makeup is really good. But yeah, you know, what does the next day look like at the old Cohen household?
And they're like, what have we done?
When Chunk is sitting around eating shreddies.
We brought this, like, 40-year-old man with clear mental and, like, issues into our house.
And strong enough to pick up an adult cop. You know, like, this is another place where the subtitles really did a great thing. Data says to his dad, wow, and then he speaks Cantonese, and the subtitles are in Cantonese to give you that psych out that maybe he's, like, swearing at that point. But the Cantonese actually translates to something like he's so strong or something like that. But it's just another one of those brilliant uses where it's like, ah, you think he's swearing. And so everyone is, you know, kind of mulling about. We've got the really awkward romance moment between Mouth and Steph.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Their whole relationship was just, why? Yeah. Why did you even bother with that? That scene between the two of them at the end has to be one of the most awkward, sexless tension scenes ever.
And so we've got Andy having the most mind-boggling line to Mikey, where she says, keep kissing girls the way you do. The parts of you that don't work so good, they're going to catch up to the ones that do. Huh? I don't.
What doesn't work good?
I don't.
Is asthma?
Well, yeah, but see, now maybe that's why, because this is where he decides he's no longer asthmatic and throws his inhaler over his shoulder into the ocean. You know, I'm just done being asthmatic. I mean, Steph can see now without her glasses. She hasn't had a problem seeing people coming. But so we've been, the parents have been searching for the kids all night. There's no doubt that they've been searching for their kids all night. This seems like the appropriate time to sign a contract. Let's just force this contract to sell your house on them. Oh, well, we've got you here. You know, hey, good thing your kids are okay, but sign this contract. But Rosalita saves the day by finding the jewels that Mikey had snuck away in his marble bag. And this is where we find out that, yeah, what you were talking about earlier, does Mouth actually know Spanish? Because it takes him a really long time to figure out that she's saying, don't sign.
Yeah.
So the day is saved because they've got all these jewels. As we watch the ship sail away, which is kind of like, we should go get the ship. Like, his dad is a museum curator. He should see that ship and go, whoa, I gotta go catch that thing. Because, like, that is going to be the greatest find of all time. But, yeah, so Cyndi Lauper starts booming, and we got credits. That's the Goonies. Now, Colin, on IMDb, it scored a 7.8 out of 10. With 235,000 reviews and a Metascore, the critic score of 62. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 75% from the critics on the tomato meter and an audience score of 91%.
Wow.
And that's 579,314 reviews has given this movie 91%. On Rotten Tomatoes, where does the Goonies fall for you?
Huh, that's crazy. 91%. Wow, I would say like I'd give it a solid 80%.
Mm-hmm.
I think for what it is, it's just like there's a lot of logical inconsistencies, a lot of like botched scenes and that kind of stuff, but. For the time that it was made and the funness of the movie, I think that the score that it gets is obviously fueled by nostalgia. It's hard to watch it for me at a first viewing at my age, and really, I don't think I'm ever going to get the full effect of what The Goonies was or what it meant to people who grew up with it.
And I feel like this is one that I would protect my own kids from.
Yeah.
Even though I probably saw this at like the age of 7 or 8 or, you know, something like that, like when it first came out. Yeah, I don't think I'd show it to my kids. There's too many shits. There's too many skeletons. My younger son won't even watch the spoof episode of Teen Titan Go because he's scared of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I can see a good solid 80. I can see the nostalgia that I have, you know, and it's weird to have the two different perspectives because, you know, I look at someone like Andy, who was my crush when I was that age, and now I look at her as an older man, and it's like I still remember being a crush on her, but now she's a 16-year-old kid, and so I've got this really weird struggle in my own brain. So it is really hard to remove the nostalgia from it. But I agree. It's a fun movie. It's Indiana Jones with kids. Yeah, I can get behind that 80%. I think if we were to average out all the scores from the four different scores, we'd probably get about 80. Well, that's The Goonies, and that is our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or whatever app you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. Doesn't matter what you say, but it's those 5 stars that drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
If you'd like to contact or donate to us, you can email us at iusedtolikethisone, all one word, @gmail.com. You can follow us on social media, on Facebook at iusedtolikethisone, @iusedtolikethisone on Instagram, or @iusedtolikethisone with numbers instead of words because of the character limit on Twitter. On social media, you'll get the heads up on what our next movie is so you can watch it ahead of time.
Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter and the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music.